So, like I said, we covered up through the Crusades. Last week we went over the Crusades, and that was our 25th lecture, our 25th history lecture. So, it took us 25 lectures to get through 1,000 years, and that scares me, because there's a lot, there's very little we have when it comes to the first 1,000 years compared to the second 1,000 years. There's a lot more history, and so I'm only imagining when we get to the Reformation. What that's going to be, I don't even know. So we'll take it as we come. But if you've kind of forgotten some of the things, like I said, you can go online, you can go back and listen to them. I finally feel like we have our audio good now. So many of our lectures weren't really great, and unfortunately, I think we finally got that fixed. So I'm saddened by that because some of our lectures are pretty much gone when it comes to the audio. But just to kind of give you a heads up, my plan when all of this is said and done is I'm going to compile all of these lectures, and I am going to write a book called A Lay Guide to Church History. And so I'm going to try to compile these lectures into really probably a two-volume set of lay lectures, lay history, for people that, for like yourselves, who are like, I ain't trying to be in seminary for 10 years, but I do like this stuff. And so kind of the way we teach it here, that's what these books are going to be. So be praying for that, and that's probably my next goal in the future. So let's get into our lesson tonight, the rise of Russian Orthodoxy. The reason we are going over this would be but a small little blurb in many church history surveys, because it's really, I mean, it's kind of a drive-by concept. But the reason that I want to take a little bit of extra time on this and really dive a little bit deeper into it is because we have so many Russian Orthodox individuals, primarily in this state. And so to really have an idea of where they're coming from, kind of why they believe what they believe, kind of what's central to their history and their faith system, is an excellent way to bridge conversations and to kind of have an understanding of where they're coming. So first, let's look at the rise of Russian Orthodoxy. After the Great Schism of 1054, the Eastern Byzantine type of Christianity flourished outside the political boundaries of the Byzantine Empire. Remember, the Byzantine Empire is the eastern part of the old Roman Empire, whereas the West now is under what we call Western, the Holy Roman Empire, which at this point in time is under Germanic rule. It's no longer under the Carolingian rule of the Franks, but is now under the Germanic rule. This was especially the case in Russia, where the Eastern faith took the vast and majestic form of the Russian Orthodox Church in the world. The story of how Russian Christianity came to birth under the inspiration of Byzantium begins in the 10th century with the contact between the Byzantine Empire and the Russian city of Kiev. The most powerful, prosperous city in Russia in the 10th century was Kiev. The rulers of Kiev were a tribal group called the Rus, who eventually gave their name to the whole of the surrounding country, Russia. So Russia is the land of the Rus. That's where that name came from. The pagan Rus were a race of aristocratic warriors who had extended their dominion form of Kiev to the neighboring Slavic tribes and towns. The Rus encouraged trade with the nearby Byzantine Empire, and this opened Kiev to Christian influence. And by 945, a church had been established in the city. The Russian princess Olga, who ruled Kiev from 945 to 964, was converted to Christianity, receiving baptism into the Eastern faith in Constantinople in 957. This conversion, however, did not lead to the Christianization of Kiev, and her son Vyacheslav, who ruled in his own right from 964, did not follow in his mother's religious example, afraid that his pagan warriors would consider him weak if he was a Christian. The wholehearted acceptance of Christianity by Kiev and Russian would not occur until Olga's grandson, Prince Vladimir, took control. And so under Olga's son, he kind of pushed back away from Christianity. He thought that his warriors wouldn't follow them. Many of them were still pagans, and he wanted their total allegiance. But under his son, Vladimir, the full Christianization of Russia occurs. Russian tradition says that Vladimir invited representatives of the four great religions of the world, Judaism, Islam, and Eastern and Western Christianity, to come to Kiev and expound the merits of their respective faiths. As it is told, Judaism and Islam did not appeal to him, and he was torn between the two wings of the Christian church. So he sent delegates to Rome and Constantinople to investigate further, and this tipped the balance toward the east. The greatest appeal to the Russian delegation was the splendor of worship demonstrated by the Eastern Church in the Church of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. They were very much attracted to the colors, to the pictures, to the icons, to the images, to all of the many styles of worship, the chantings, and then how they did the chanting in the forms of singing, the antiphonal singing in the Eastern style of worship was very attractive to the Russian delegation. And what makes this as important is because Russians were always to prize their beautiful forms of worship more highly than doctrinal orthodoxy or codes of morality. So one of the most central concepts to Russian orthodoxy is not doctrine, it's appearance. And if you go into Russia, primarily Moscow, you'll see that Russian orthodoxy is a religion built upon beauty. I mean, their paintings, their style, the dome-shaped buildings that they have there are all central to this idea of the aesthetic concept of worship to them. According to tradition, Vladimir embraced Byzantine Christianity in the year 988. Many of the Rus followed their leader's example in baptism and were baptized in the river Dnieper, while at the same time these new converts hurled the idol of the Rus chief pagan god Perun down the hilltop above Kiev. Vladimir then set out to turn Kiev into a Christian kingdom that paralleled the Byzantine Empire. The Patriarch of Constantinople appointed a metropolitan bishop in Kiev to lead the Russian church, and this practice would continue for the next 500 years. So Byzantine hears about what's happening there in Russia with them embracing Eastern Orthodoxy. So the emperor sends and he appoints a metropolitan, that is a leader, a localized leader, to serve over all of Kiev, to kind of be the spiritual and national leader there over the Kievan Russians. Vladimir married Anna, sister of the great Byzantine emperor Basil II. He invited Byzantine monks to settle in Kiev, and they brought Byzantine culture and civilization with them, translating the Byzantine liturgy and other writings into Slavonic by means of the Cyrillic alphabet. This gave Russians something that Western worshipers did not have, a religion they could understand in their own native language. And that is so important. Remember, in the West, everything at this point is done in Latin. There's only a single group that is allowed to utilize the Latin, and that is the priestly class, the noble class, the peasants, the lay people. They cannot read the liturgy. They cannot read the liturgy, and they cannot read the scriptures. And that is central to the perversion and the corruption we see happening in the West. But in the East actually champions translating the liturgy and the scriptures into the national languages. And so what's interesting, when we see like pre-reformers, for instance, with Wycliffe, who translates the Bible into English, him and the Lollards, this was not the first time the Bible was translated in a native language. This was happening all the time in the East. Unfortunately, in the West, it was not being done so, and which is why I believe the corruption was able to get as far as it did in many ways. A distinctive Russian style of church building came into existence during this time, marked out by an onion-shaped dome. Like I said, if you ever go see pictures of Moscow or Russia, you see these onion-shaped domes filling the place. Further, Vladimir took very seriously. After Vladimir's death in 1015, conflict broke out between his 12 sons. One of them, Sviatopolk, decided to kill his two younger brothers, Boris and Gleb, as rivals to the throne. But in taking literal Christ's command to turn the other cheek, the brothers gave themselves up to their brother's soldiers and were mercilessly killed without any resistance. Later on, the two brothers were considered as saints and martyrs by the Russians because they willingly chose to imitate Christ in his voluntary suffering. This led to the sense in Russia that identifying with the suffering Christ became one of the most powerful themes in Russian Christianity. So for them, for Russian Orthodoxy, the central aspect for how one becomes like Christ is through the venue of suffering. The more you suffer, and the more you should suffer, the more you become like Christ. And so those who suffered most or who embraced the suffering lifestyle are championed as the greatest saints in Russian Orthodoxy. Sviatopolk's actions brought on a long civil war from which another of Vladimir's sons, Yaroslav the Wise, emerged as the ultimate victor, vanquishing all of his rivals in 1036. Under Yaroslav's rule, Kiev became the intellectual and artistic capital of all Russia, and Christianity prospered there. Yaroslav had the Bible translated into Slavonic, and in the middle of the 11th century, a great monastic revival took place in Kiev. The chief figure of this movement were the monks Antony and Theodosius. Antony, who lived in the Byzantine monastic community of Mount Athos, founded what became known as the Monastery of the Caves, just outside of Kiev, in about 1051, and it would become the most important center of religious life in Kievan Russia for the next 200 years. Theodosius was his successor, and he reorganized the monastery, introducing what was called the Studite rule of the great Byzantine monastery of Studium in Constantinople. Theodosius is one of the greatest and most loved saints in Russian Orthodoxy. He emphasized the need to endure suffering humbly for Christ's sake and to never fight back. And this, we're not going to get to it here, but this mindset within Russian Orthodoxy of the turn the other cheek mentality was central to the rise of communism and the destruction of Christianity in Russia and the Soviet Union. We'll see that at a much later date, but this will be central to the mindset of many Russians that maintained within them this mindset. He had also been born into a wealthy family, but renounced all his riches and chose to work with slaves in the fields. Theodosius left a lasting impact on Russian spirituality, especially through the biography of him by one of his fellow monks, Nestor, who wrote the very important work of Annals, which is the primary source of information on early Russian church history. Much of the stuff I have here today comes from Nestor's Annals of the Christian faith in Russia. Russia sought to imitate Byzantine worship very closely, and during the schism of 1054, they were greatly involved siding with the East. After 1054, the Russian church officially took the name of the Russian Orthodox Church, showing its allegiance to Eastern Orthodoxy and its specific brand of Orthodoxy, which became known as Russian Orthodoxy. Through the work of Antony, Theodosius, and the powerful monasteries, monasticism became the driving force and most important channel for the development of Russian Orthodoxy. In the 12th century, especially the growth of the monastic movement in Kievan Russia was incredible. Prior to 1100, there were less than 20 monasteries in all of Russia. And during that one century, from the 11th to 1200, over 50 monasteries were added. Russian monasticism fell into three types. There was first what we call cremitic monasticism, and that's solitary. That's being a hermit, totally isolating yourself from all of the world by yourself and living alone. Secondly, there's cenobitic monasticism, and that's community monasticism. That's creating this great monastery where you have not only men, but also women monks in many ways. This is before any kind of concept of nunnery was developed yet. But you would have this idea of communal monasticism. And then finally, what we call skete type, which is simply a kind of a mix between the two. And most of the time, the skete type was usually between 10 to 12 men primarily that lived in a group under the lead of a single leader. There was kind of a head monk over those 12 men. It was meant to follow the Jesus and the 12 disciples model. That's really the idea that came behind the skete type monasticism. Some of the great Christian figures in Kievan Russia included Hilarion of Kiev and Cyril of Tarov. Hilarion was one of the first native Russian metropolitans of Kiev, and one of the most learned authors and eloquent preachers of the Kievan period. His most famous work was his Sermon on Law and Grace, where he expounded the distinction between the Old and New Testaments based on the Apostle Paul's contrast in Galatians 4 between Abraham's two sons, Ishmael, symbolizing the Old Testament religion of law and compulsion, and Isaac, symbolizing the New Testament religion of spirit and freedom. It's actually a really good work on the distinction between the Old and New Covenants, but also the continuity between the covenants which flow throughout. Really kind of paved the way from a proto-covenant theology there. It's really good stuff if you're into that. This work was also central in outlining Hilarion's belief in the importance of history in God's purposes. Hilarion thought that Russia had a special place in the outworking of God's historical plan. a view which came to be shared by many Russian Orthodox believers. Very much so, we'll see by the end. Hilarion felt that through its baptism in Christ, Russia had become the spiritual equal of Byzantium. And he worked directly with Yaroslav the Wise in boldly affirming the Russian church's equal dignity of Constantinople. His goal was not to see Russian Orthodoxy as simply a daughter church of Constantinople, but as an equal form of Orthodoxy with Constantinople. Cyril was a bishop of Tarav and the most outstanding theologian and writer of the times. He became famous in his own lifetime for his sermons, letters, and written prayers, which were still popular in Russia 500 years after his death. And he was an accomplished student of the early church fathers, and in many ways he was closer to Augustine than was normal for most Orthodox thinkers. He was actually very Western, primarily with his views of Augustine, more so in his soteriology than his ecclesiology. And that is where Cyril, in many ways, in his doctrine of soteriology, is going to be more closer to the reformers than many in the West during this same period of time in the Middle Ages. Cyril emphasized the overwhelming power of the majesty of God and the utter helplessness of the sinner who can only cry out for God's mercy. His most celebrated masterpiece was his series of 8 sermons for the 8 Sundays of Easter, beginning with Palm Sunday. So basically with Palm Sunday and 8 sermons after there, or for 7 sermons after Palm Sunday. It was central to the work that came through the active and passive obedience through the incarnation of Christ and his life, death, and resurrection. Very powerful Christology in those 8 sermons. A new power arises. So here you have Kievan Christianity. Russian Orthodox is beginning to flourish there in the mid to late 12th century and into the 13th century. Right now it's looking as if the church in Kiev and Russian Orthodoxy is going to surpass Constantinople and Byzantine Eastern Orthodoxy. But something happens, a new power rises, and things totally change. Disaster befell Kiev and Russia in the 13th century at the hands of a new military powerhouse which had risen in the Far East, the Mongols. The great warrior leader Genghis Khan had unified the nomadic tribes who lived in the region between the Gobi Desert and Lake Baikal, which is present-day Mongolia. After establishing his headquarters in Karakoram, he embarked on a devastating campaign of world conquest. In the early 1200s, the Mongol armies invaded Russia and decisively defeated the Russians at the Battle of the River Kalka in 1223. The death of Genghis Khan in 1227 brought a temporary halt to the Mongol advance, but they returned in 1236, led by Genghis's grandson, Batu Khan. In 1240, Batu's forces captured Kiev and massacred its inhabitants. The only thing that saved the whole of Europe from being conquered by the Mongols was the sudden death of Batu, which is known as the Great Khan. It's actually interesting that Batu conquered more land than Genghis did. Genghis just organized the Mongolian tribes, drove them, but his grandson Batu was actually far greater leader, in my opinion, and conquered more lands. And had he not died tragically, it's very likely that they probably could have taken all of Europe at this time. In 1240, Batu's forces captured Kiev. I already said that. The Mongol tribal leaders had to return to Karakoram to elect a new great Khan, and as such, Western Europe was saved. However, southern Russia, which is modern-day Ukraine at the time, remained completely under Mongol control. And the Mongol leaders compelled even the princes and cities of northern Russia to pay annual tribute to them. The Russian-Mongol kingdom broke away from the wider empire as an independent state and became known as the Golden Horde from the yellow costumes worn by Genghis Khan and his ruling tribe. It had its capital at Sarai near the Caspian Seas, and these Mongol rulers of Russia are sometimes called Tartars from the name of the tribe which provided the Mongols with an advance guard of shock troops. After the destruction of Kiev by the Mongols, Russian Orthodox believers would often look back on Kiev and Russia as the greatest era of Christianity in Russian history. It served as the spiritual ideal that all succeeding generations strive to imitate. So this golden age from around 1014 to the fall of them in around 1223 was really the golden age of Russian Orthodoxy. And from this point on, after Russian Orthodoxy would be reestablished after the conquering of the Mongols, they would always, the goal would always be to get back to this golden age of Russian Orthodoxy that was established there in Kiev during this period of time. Before we keep moving on with what continues to happen with Russian Orthodoxy, I want to take a little bit of a step back and look at something else that was happening paralleling with Russian Orthodoxy. And there are some very important things that happened here. And I want to look at Serbian Orthodoxy, the rise of the Serbians. And the reason why this is going to be big is because the Crimean Wars are going to be very important later on in history, specifically the wars that take place within Serbia, between the Serbian and the Bosnians. These are going to be really important things that happen later on in history. So just to kind of give us an idea of how Christianity was established in Serbia, since it was happening really parallel with the rise of Russian Orthodoxy. The Russians were the largest Slavic group, but other branches of the Slav family were also central in the story of Eastern Orthodoxy. None were more important than the Serbs, and no Serb was spiritually greater than the man Sava. He is often called the enlightener of the Serbs because of the way that he single-handedly cemented the Serbian people's loyalty to Orthodoxy over against Western Catholicism. And what Sava's life most greatly demonstrates is the political and religious conflicts that endured between East and West after the Great Schism. Sava was born with the name Ratko and was the third child of King Stephen Nemanja of Serbia. And at age 15, he was made prince over a strip of Serbian territory by his father. However, Ratko, from the earliest of ages, was far more captivated with heaven and the things of God, and had vowed to live a celibate life even in his teens. After being visited by a Russian Orthodox monk, Ratko's heart desperately desired to follow in the monastic lifestyle, and he persuaded the monk to take him secretly back to the monastery at Mount Athos. His father sent soldiers to look for his runaway son, but Ratko just managed to keep one step ahead of them. By the time the soldiers arrived to Athos, the 18-year-old prince had been swiftly tonsured, and that just simply means enrolled as a monk, and taken the new name Sava, after the famous 6th-century Palestinian monk, Savas the Sanctified. The soldiers had to journey back empty-handed, and Sava's illustrious spiritual career began. At this point, there was no Serbian monasteries. So Sava had joined a Greek one, and Sava's first major contribution to Serbian Orthodoxy would be to establish a monastic community for Serbs there at Mount Athos. What is interesting is at the age of 82, his father actually resigned his throne and joined Sava as a monk and took the name Simeon. So his father was really angry at first about this, obviously. His son decided to be a monk. But actually, after 82, he resigned his throne, gives it to one of his other sons, and goes and joins Sava and becomes a monk and takes the name Simeon. The father and son team set out to rebuild the Greek monastery of Hilandar for use by their fellow Serbs, and their influence at the Byzantine court caused the Byzantine emperor Alexius III to grant Hilandar to the Serbian people for use as an independent, self-governing monastery. From that day forward, Hilandar became a vital center of Serbian religion and culture, attracting multitudes of young Serbian men to Mount Athos and the monastic life. Sava then built a private cell for himself. Literally, it was a cell inside the monastery where the only thing that was not sealed off was about, I think it was like a 6-inch by 6-inch slit at the bottom. It was literally concreted into the room. There he could pass out jugs and bedpans and food and things like that. But that's literally how he lived his whole life, was in this back dark room with a little slit that was the only thing, that was the only kind of communication he had between people. He would pass out his writings and things like that. Sava then built a private cell, becoming a hermit and spending the rest of his days in solitude writing hymns, prayers, treaties, and biography of his father, who died in 1200. Meanwhile, Serbia had toppled into a bloody civil war between Simeon's second son, Sava's brother, King Stephen, and Simeon's other son, Vukan. If there's anything the Middle Ages teach you, is pray that you don't have more than two sons. Because if you do, they're going to end up fighting each other. That's just like it always happens everywhere. There's civil wars, and it's always between sons trying to take the rule. Stephen controlled the northern and eastern region of Serbia, while Vukan, the southern and western part. Here, the struggle between Catholicism and Orthodoxy reared its ugly head. because Lucan received support from the papacy of Innocent III, who was also the most politically powerful figure ever to occupy the papacy. We'll look at Innocent III a little later on in our lecture series. In order to gain his support, Lucan pledged the Serbian churches in his land to the papacy. And as such, the conflict between Stephen and Lucan became in many ways less political and more religious. What used to be just two brothers trying to take control over all of Serbia now became Western Catholicism trying to take all of Serbia and Eastern Orthodoxy trying to hold all of Serbia. Things looked very bad for the Orthodox when a crusading army overthrew the Byzantine Empire in 1204, capturing Constantinople and setting up a new French Catholic kingdom. Serbian Orthodox laid prostrate beneath the swords of Catholic conquerors, and it almost became extinct. However, after pleas from his brother Stephen, Sava returned to a devastated Serbia in 1207 to help heal the wounds of the nation. And what he did is crazy. He brought his father back to Serbia. His father had been dead. And he opened the casket of his body that was still fresh, despite being dead 7 years. And tradition says it exuded a sweet smell of oils and myrrh. And that was accepted as proof that a dead believer was a true saint. So if they opened your casket a few years after you're dead, and you still looked pretty preserved and had a still sweet smell of fragrance, you were considered someone who definitely made it to heaven. They're in heaven and they're a true saint. And that is where we actually get the term, the odor of sanctity. If you start reading many of these middle-aged fathers, these middle-aged teachers, and you read them talking about the odor of sanctity, you're like, what are they talking about? It's because they went and examined the body years after they died, and if they were still preserved, they were considered, well, hey, they're a true saint for sure. And what's interesting is that this concept, this idea of how to identify a true saint, has never been changed or written out of rule in both Western Catholicism, Roman Catholicism now, and Eastern Orthodoxy. It is still considered a practice of how to identify true sainthood. So I don't think they do it, but it's still on the books. And so it's an interesting idea that is definitely middle age in its action. The presentation of their father and the proof of his sanctity caused the brothers to reconcile and end the civil war. But for years, Serbia still remained pressed under the papacy. Sava became the abbot of Studentia Monastery, and from there spent all his energies revitalizing Orthodoxy among the Serbs. Serbs began, and still do, to look at Sava as the ideal Christian man. And it was noticed by many in the Byzantine Empire when in 1219 he was recognized as Serbia's first archbishop, which granted Serbian Orthodoxy a large measure of national independence. Sava became so famous that after his death in 1236, even Catholics came from far and paid honor to his body. The Turkish Muslims, which were the Ottoman Turks, conquered Serbia in 1389. And Sava's shrine became such a powerful beacon of hope for the Serbian Christians that in 1595, the Muslim authorities dug up his body and burned it in order to try and desecrate and destroy his memory. And so the idea of Sava was such a powerful beacon that maintained guidance for the Serbian Christians. And for them, their suffering was a sign of their sainthood. It was a sign of them being made more like Christ. And so they were okay with it. And the Muslims hated this. And so they sought to remove anything that could bring hope to the Serbian Christians. And for them, it was to dig up the body and to totally destroy it by burning it and hopefully desecrating his memory, even though that would not be the case. Though Ottoman Turks and the Muslim concept would totally overwhelm and become the single major belief system there within Serbia after a while. And that will be central to the Bosnian-Serbian conflict when we get to that point. Now kind of back to Russia, but now there's a new head, a new powerhouse that rises up in Russian Orthodoxy. It's no longer Kiev. It's going to be this new city, this new place that kind of comes out of the middle of the woods in this new city, which will be called Moscow. And we know what Moscow is today. The Mongols who invaded Russia were pagans. However, they did acknowledge a supreme god and allowed their conquered subjects to worship the supreme god according to their own religious traditions. And the Russian Orthodox Church therefore survived the Mongol invasions. What's interesting is they have an idea of a supreme god. And basically, your religious traditions can worship the supreme God however you want. Their idea was the supreme God accepts all kinds of worship, so you just keep doing what you're doing, and we'll just say you're worshiping our supreme God. It reminds me very much of the Areopagus, right? And the unknown God, the altar of the unknown God. And the way Paul uses that to say, let me tell you about this unknown God. It's kind of, for the Romans, it was a little bit different. The Romans, it was, well, in case we forget somebody, let's just have an altar for the unknown God. But for the Mongols, it was, we believe in one supreme God, but we believe he accepts worship of all, and we just put him at the top. So that was kind of the Mongol idea. And so because of that, Russian Orthodoxy was not threatened. They were allowed to continue worshiping. They were not seen as a religious threat by the Mongols. Indeed, during the period of Mongol rule under the Golden Horde from 1240 to 1480, it was chiefly Russian Orthodoxy which kept Russian national feelings alive. And this was because the church forbade intermarriage between Russians and Mongols, and also because Russian nationalism and Russian Orthodoxy became fused together in opposition to the non-Christian beliefs of the conquering Mongols. The state and the church really fused together into what became Russian Orthodoxy, but it was very nationalistic. It was very much, there was an allegiance to God was almost equated with an allegiance to the nation. And this was a way that they felt that they could embrace and stand against these pagan Mongols. And really the closest reflection that I can think of that would kind of, we would be reminded of is the rise of the moral majority movement against those godless communists, right? The 70s and the 80s are the peak of American church attendance. You can say Christianity or not, but it was the peak of church attendance, and a lot of that had to do with us fighting those godless communists, right? And so it's amazing how nationalism and religion can so often fuse together when you feel as if it's a strengthening against a common opponent. And that's really what we see here with Russian Orthodoxy. Russian Christians made little to no effort to evangelize their Mongol masters, who in fact soon abandoned paganism only to embrace Islam. An important center of Christian civilization in Russia, which escaped the Mongol conquest, was the northern city of Novgorod. By 1150, it had become one of the most prosperous trading cities in Europe and had secured a large measure of political and ecclesiastical freedom from the church's rule in Kiev. However, when Kiev fell to the Mongols in 1240, Novgorod became for a time the guardian of Russia's national freedom and orthodoxy under the rule of Prince Alexander Nevsky, one of the great national heroes of Russia and Russian Orthodoxy. Nevsky was a kind of holy warrior king who had fought off two attempts by Western crusaders from conquering northern Russia. He made peace with the Mongols, but refused to make any terms of peace with crusaders, because the Mongols allowed the Orthodox Christians to worship how they wanted, while the crusaders forced the Russians to surrender to the papacy. And so once again, like we saw in many cases in the East, where the Byzantine Christians would fight with the Muslims against the crusaders, because the crusaders would not allow the Eastern Orthodox to worship their own way. They forced them to surrender to the papacy. And so many times, the Orthodox were way more willing to side with either those who had conquered them or the other things like that, because they were still allowed to practice their belief system and their ideas of worship. Nevsky was instrumental in the rise of Moscow as the new center of Russian national life. Moscow was southeast of Novgorod in central Russia. It was protected by thick forest with a large population, and outside the sphere of direct Mongol rule. So Moscow was a fairly large city. It had a pretty large population. But what protected it was surrounded by very dense and dark forest. And if you didn't know the forest very well, it was a very dangerous place to be. And it served as one of their greatest defense. And as such, it allowed Moscow to remain fairly untouched by the Mongols. Nevsky established a dominion there for his son Daniel. And during his reign, the territory was expanded. The growing empire of Moscow became known as Muscovy. And its first great ruler was Ivan I. This is going to create a long line of Ivans, who took the title Grand Prince in 1328. Under Ivan's leadership, Moscow became the center of anti-Mongol sentiment. Peter, the Metropolitan of Kiev, made Moscow into the new residence of the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church. So the metropolitan now moves to Moscow because it's safer. There's less Mongol influence. And so Moscow now becomes the center where the leader, the spiritual and national leader of Russia begins to dwell. It was here that a strong alliance between church and state was developed. The central figure here was Sergius of Radonezh, whom Russians regard as their greatest national saint. He's basically the Russian equivalent of the Serbian Sava. Sergius was born into a rich family, but gave up all his privileges in order to follow a life of humility and suffering to imitate Christ. Sergius began his religious life as a hermit in the middle of a forest about 20 miles or so outside of Moscow. He reputed to see many visions and began to grow a band of spiritual disciples, which in 1340 he formed into the Monastery of the Holy Trinity. And this would now become the center of Russian Orthodoxy. So where originally in the north was at Mount Athos in Kiev, now the new spiritual center of Russia is in Moscow at the Monastery of the Holy Trinity. Sergius was the main spiritual force behind a mighty new wave of colonist monks who spread out into the northern forest of Russia and established monasteries as centers of Orthodox Christianity and civilization and evangelized the pagan natives in the land. One of the most important of these missionaries was Stephen of Perm, who evangelized the Finnish tribe of northern Russia known as the Serenes, giving their language a written form for the first time and translating the Bible and the Orthodox liturgy into. See, what's amazing is my wife bought me a Mac. Let me break off and give you a little story. My wife bought me a Mac for my birthday. It's awesome. I love it. It's a great thing. The problem is it took what I hate most about my iPhone, and that's autocorrect, and brought it into my world of scholarship. And so now when I'm typing, I'll end up reading something I wrote, and I was like, I don't even know what I was saying now, because they don't even have a good typo to see. I just have this new word that got created for me, and I don't even know where I was going with it. So little story to break in there for that. One of the major things that came out of the Monastery of the Holy Trinity in Moscow was a powerful new tradition of Russian religious art. This is central to Russian Orthodoxy, is their art. Very vital to it. These monk artists did not attach their names to the icons they painted, but we know that two of the most distinguished were Daniel Chorny and Andrei Rublev. Rublev actually became known as one of the most famous religious artists in the world, and he painted what is considered the most famous Orthodox icon of all time called the Trinity. And this is it right here. Now, the issue that I have with it is these are actually not the Trinity, in my opinion. After reading Rublev, I don't think it's the Trinity. Many people look at it as that. But when writing, this is actually the story of the angel of the Lord and the two other angels meeting with Abraham at Mamre in Genesis 18. And the reason why I believe that is because there's only one of them that is centered as holy. And we see this in the center here, and that's Christ. And the reason we know that's Christ is because in Orthodox painting, Christ is always painted with two colors, red and blue. Blue symbolized Christ's humanity, and the red, his deity. So that's just an interesting thought. When you look at Orthodox icons and their paintings, if you see a figure with red and blue, you can automatically know that's Christ. Because it's those two colors symbolize his incarnation, his God-manness. And so that's interesting. And I think these are just the two other angels there. I don't think that's the Father and the Holy Spirit. So many people call it the Trinity. I just think it's a picture based upon Rublev's own writings of the angel of the Lord, which was a pre-incarnate Christ, a Christophany, and the two other angels meeting with Abraham and Mamre. But just a neat picture, because this is considered the most famous picture in Eastern Orthodoxy and of all of them. So, and it came out of Russian Orthodoxy. So it's really neat. You can look that up. Andrei Rublev, and it's called the Trinity, but I don't think that's what he was trying to paint. Icons were as important in the Orthodoxy of Russia as they were in Byzantium. They hung in vast numbers on the walls of churches and inside the huts of peasants in the palaces of princes. No matter whose house you went into, whether it was a hut or a palace, you were going to see these icons, these religious paintings and carvings. It was so important to them. Russians believe that some icons possess miraculous powers. For instance, the famous icon, Our Lady from Vladimir, which is a picture of the Virgin Mary holding an infant Christ, was said to have saved Moscow from Russian invasions 3 times. Don't know how they guessed that. They just said it did. That was the reason that they could give justification for them not being conquered, was that icon. It's like, all right. Another big movement in Russian Orthodoxy was that of hesychastic spirituality. Now, hesychasm is the idea of a transcendent prayer, kind of. It's the idea of going into such a deep sense of meditation in prayer that one can truly grasp the full knowledge of God through the experience of it. And the idea that they got this hesychasm from was Jesus' teaching on going into the prayer closet. The idea was to go into such a place of isolation and quietness and to be able to silence one's thoughts in such a way that one could almost engage directly with God and have his knowledge given to them through an experiential sense of prayer. So this was a very, very, we're going to see this real big next lesson in the rise of the mystics and the scholastics and the mystics. This was a big mystical concept, was this hesychasm, this complacent, deep, transcendental prayer, which is what they were practicing. In 1389, Prince Dmitry Donsko went to battle against the Golden Horde and inflicted a great defeat against them in the Battle of Kulikovo. However, the Mongolians under Samarkand Turmaline almost recreated the Mongolian Empire similar to Genghis Khan. And had it not been for his death, Russia would likely have been annexed into the Mongolian Empire. The result of these conflicts was the breakup of the Golden Horde into a number of smaller Mongol Muslim states around the Crimea and the Caspian Sea. This enabled the Russian Orthodox Kingdom of Muscovy to become the dominant power in the region. And by the time of Grand Prince Ivan III, Moscow had enough military and political strength for Ivan to proclaim himself as the sole ruler of Russia. Ivan threw off the Mongol yoke decisively in 1480 by putting an end to all payments of tribute, and Orthodox Russia was finally free. So in 1480, we see a united Russia under the leadership of Ivan III. This is the first time they are not under Byzantine rule, nor are they under national rule, another leadership. And this is central to the establishment of what we're going to see later on called Holy Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church also became free from ecclesiastical rule of Constantinople during this period. However, at the Council of Florence in 1439, the Metropolitan of Kiev accepted the submission of Orthodoxy to the papacy in return for Western military support against the Ottoman Turks. This agreement was known as the Union of Florence. However, when papal delegates arrived in Moscow in 1441, they found a church that angrily rejected the union and the papacy and threw the delegates into prison and then later allowed them to escape back to Italy. So it didn't work out the way the papacy thought. The Constantinople basically saw Russia as a bargaining tool. If you give us Western troops to support us against the Ottoman Turks, we will give you Russia. We will give you Russian Orthodoxy and have them submit under the papacy. Now, Russia had no part in that. And they were like, whoa, okay, that's not how it's going to work when they get here. So these papal delegates roll into Moscow thinking they're going to take it over, and they get thrown right into prison. They're not having it. And eventually, they do let them flee back to Italy. This meant that Russian Orthodoxy no longer had any oversight from either Rome or Constantinople. From 1458 on, the Russian Orthodoxy Church was governed by the Metropolitan of Moscow. The 14th and 15th centuries in Russia saw the outbreak of the first great movements of Russian religious dissent. And this is going to be on from basically the 14th century on, you are going to see religious dissent in Russia to all the way up to the communist rise. And that's going to be the final religious dissent, which will be the total destruction of religion in communist Russia. The first group was the Strigolniki, which is basically Russian for shaved heads, who protested against low moral standards of the clergy. Then they rejected the priesthood and sacraments. And finally, they denied the doctrine of the resurrection. So this was the first group of religious sinners, the Strigolniki. They were a former priest who shaved all their heads and totally was going after the priesthood. Then there was a second group during the same time. And this was called the Judaizers. Now, these Judaizers are not like the Judaizers we see that Paul is dealing with in the New Testament, primarily in the books of Galatians and Philippians. These are not those Judaizers who are simply trying to add circumcision and the works of the law to salvation. These Judaizers were basically Jews who had also combined Judaism with Gnosticism. It was very Gnostic in its concept, and so it was a very mystical form of Judaism. It was a strange blend of those two things, and it was perhaps influenced by the Bogomils of Bulgaria. The Bogomils were a Gnostic group of Christians, a group of heretical Christians in Bulgaria that taught the dualism that we looked at in the early first century, that there were two kinds of gods. The New Testament God was saving us from the Old Testament God, and so on and so forth. The very same dualism we talked about in the early parts of our lectures. A people of destiny. That is what Russia began to see themselves as. They began to see themselves as a people of destiny. After the fall of Byzantium to the Ottoman Turks in 1453, a new Russian Orthodox Empire stepped forth to champion the faith of Eastern Christianity. And this transfer took place in a number of ways. In 1472, Ivan II of Moscow married Sophia, the niece of the last Byzantine emperor, and the niece of the last Byzantine emperor, and established a royal bloodline between Russia and Byzantium. Ivan III took over the sign of Byzantium, which was the double eagle, and then made it the official emblem of Russian power. So if you remember Hitler's sign, you have the swastika on top of the eagle. This is where that comes from. The eagle becomes the symbol of Russian power, and Hitler will adopt that. He actually robs that and takes the eagle for Germany, and then puts because the eagle is obviously a great symbol of power. And so it's amazing to see how all of these signs and symbols, and then obviously the swastika was originally an Indian sign of peace. And so he adopts a couple different symbols there and puts it there. His son, Ivan III's son, Ivan IV, known as Ivan the Terrible, a lot more well known, assumed the title Tsar, which came from Caesar. And then the Terrible, Ivan the Terrible, crowned himself the successor of the Caesars. And the Tsar title would remain until the communist revolt and the Russian Revolution. And so the Tsar title comes from the term Caesar, and Ivan the Terrible takes that title because he sees himself as the direct successor of both the Roman and Byzantine emperors. He is now the new Caesar. Russian Orthodox theologians began to look at Moscow as the third Rome. The first Rome was Rome itself, which they believed had departed from the true faith under the corrupt papacy. Moscow was now seen as the spiritual capital of the Orthodox Christian faith. Having secured their national independence from the Mongols and their spiritual independence from Byzantium, the Orthodox people of Russia became imbued with a sense of their special divine mission and destiny. In much of the same way Protestant Britain and America would later regard themselves, Russia became in its own mind Holy Russia, God's chosen land. As the Russian theologian Philotheus said, Moscow shone brighter than the sun as the third Rome, and there would not be a fourth. And so this is what we see with the rise of Russian Orthodoxy, a very national religion that is imbued with both Christianity and nationalism, but also is imbued with a very aesthetic appeal, an idea of beauty and array and art and architecture. This is very central to Russian Orthodoxy, and it would remain as such for the next four decades or so with the rise of communism. And as the rise of communism would pour into Russia and the Russian Revolution, we would see the total destruction of much of what Christianity was there. And what people don't realize is as Hitler was brutally murdering millions of Jews, Stalin was brutally murdering millions of Christians. And it's estimated that during the rise of Stalin, it's between 10 to 13 million Christians were killed at the hands of Joseph Stalin. And as unfortunately, I call that the Holocaust that's been forgotten. A lot of people miss that inside of what Hitler was doing and where our attention really was focused during that time. And so that's what we're going to see. We'll see a little bit more of that, but that's really the rise of Russian Orthodoxy. That's the foundation that began it. And for the next 3 to 4 centuries, Russian Orthodoxy will be the heartbeat of Eastern Orthodoxy. and it will be what really keeps it going and flourishing and maintaining itself against the rise of the scholasticism that's going to come out of the West, which is going to provide a great deeper doctrinal depth than what Eastern Orthodoxy will be able to stand against. And so it'll be interesting to see how those two balance together. Well, that's where we're going to close tonight. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. And thanks for being here. Let's pray. Father God, I just thank you so much for this time we have to learn. God, there's just so much, so many details, so many things, and there's so much for us to miss, God. But the one thing that we just need to see in all of this is that, God, you're in control. Every single thing that's happened throughout all of human history, you've been in control of. Every king that's been put in place and every king that's been torn down, every position, every church that's been brought up, every church that's been torn down, all of it is because of your sovereign hand in guiding your story, and that's history. All of it is working towards your redemption. And God, we thank you. We thank you that you have never left your church, even when it's left you at times, that you've never gotten away from your promises, that you will always be faithful. You'll be faithful to bring what you have begun to completion. And we are thankful that you are a God who is faithful to your promises. We ask that you would bless everyone throughout this week. Keep them safe. Be over their homes and with their families. God, we thank you for all that you do for us. We just say all of these things in the precious name of Jesus Christ. Amen.